The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Rough day for the Democrats yesterday. Adam Schiff brought he finally brought the impeachment trial to an end, saying that if they did not convict and remove this president from office, he could give Alaska to the Russians. He could hand over the White House to Jared Kushner. So they have to act, he said. That was Adam Schiff yesterday. He was the one heading up the trial for the House managers, or leading the House managers. And then last night, as everyone anxiously gathered around the cable news stations to find out the results of the Iowa caucus, well, the results never came in. But then that didn't stop Pete Buttigieg from declaring victory. What a day. And I guess now it goes on into today to figure out who's ahead, who won. Quite a few people in the Democrat. I'll talk a little bit more about this as we proceed. I also want to get into a few stories about Israel following on the deal of the century and just the change in direction with this new administration. Some interesting poll numbers coming out of Israel as well, the reaction coming from the Israeli public, including the Arab population in Israel. We'll look at that if we have time later in this segment, too. There's a story at the Telegraph, I believe, about just how intolerant the left here in the UK is, blocking a popular American evangelist from his speaking engagements. I guess he had a number of them lined up in the UK, and a lot of those venues are canceling those engagements. So we'll look at that, among other things, a little bit later. But I want to begin with Brexit and the impact that it will have on the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. As I've been saying, at the PAC over the weekend in Birmingham, and then we just recorded another Key of David program for the UK just this morning, where I used some of that material and reminded viewers, or it'll go to to TV this weekend, but just pointing them to what Mr. Armstrong said in 1973, not only about Brexit not being any part of the oncoming final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, but what about the empire itself, those 10 nations, those 10 kings, Revelation 17 and verse 12, that all have one mind, verse 13 says, and then they come together for a short time, and they're going to cause a lot of problems for this world. It's going to plunge this entire world into world war. Three world wars in the span of what? A little over a century? Think of the lessons that we refuse to learn, even the lessons from our own history. Leave aside prophecy and just look at the history. Look at the string of failures. Today's the 75th anniversary of the Yalta Conference. That was the conference right at the tail end of World War II. They met in February of 1945 at this worn-out Soviet seaside resort in Yalta. That's in the Crimean Peninsula in Ukraine. Winston Churchill called it the Riviera of Hades. Not the greatest location, I guess, for a conference. But World War II was winding down, finally. Germany's great counteroffensive in the West, the Battle of the Bulge, it had been defeated. Russian troops were only 40 miles from Germany, 40 miles from Berlin, actually. And here come these three world leaders, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, Joseph Stalin, and they're meeting to hammer out a peace agreement. to bring peace to the world, to ensure that we never, ever have anything like World War II again. Roosevelt's priority was to get Russia to help in the war against Japan. As soon as Germany surrendered, he wanted Russia to help with Japan. Now, Churchill was much more wary of Stalin than Roosevelt was. He wanted to make sure that that Stalin didn't take over Poland and Eastern Europe, for that matter. He wanted to make sure, he wanted assurances that there would be free democracies in the East, Eastern Europe. And of course, we now know that Stalin's goal was just the opposite. Never mind what he said at the conference, or thereafter, soon thereafter. His goal was to dominate Poland. His goal was to dominate Eastern Europe. We now know what happened. But coming out of that conference, you had President Roosevelt saying, it's a huge success. It's very similar to the way that the West dealt with Hitler in the 1930s. Now they've gone through this world war, 60 million deaths, 60 million people killed. And they sit down with another dictator, another authoritarian. And then coming out of Yalta, they say, yeah, we've reached a peace deal. Roosevelt said following the conference that Yalta spells the end of the system of unilateral action, the exclusive alliances, the spheres of influence, the balance of power, and all the other expedients that have been tried for centuries and have always failed. And in the weeks and months that followed, like with just about every peace conference, initially there were some positive signs that, of course, fooled everyone. Stalin said all the right things. He said about a free and independent Poland because the Russians had greatly sinned against Poland. This is Stalin. He said the Soviet government was trying to atone for those sins. Poland must be strong, and the Soviet Union is interested in the creation of a mighty, free, and independent Poland. The perfect words to convince Roosevelt that he just wanted peace. He wanted peace for Poland and for Eastern Europe. Churchill, as I said, was much more wary. He wanted guarantees. He wanted international supervision over the Polish elections. But Roosevelt, just like they dealt with Hitler in the 30s, he did not want to upset Stalin. So all that he got was this meaningless declaration. Look, all we want is for Poland to decide for themselves. There was one member of the American diplomatic team, Admiral Leahy, who complained about the agreement with Stalin, saying that it was so elastic that the Russians can stretch it all the way from Yalta to Washington without ever technically breaking it. In other words, Russia can just do whatever it wants. Once the dust settles, then Russia will just have free rein. Poland was doomed. Roosevelt goes in, hands all this over to Stalin, and then says, yeah, we'll pull our U.S. troops out of Poland within 2 years. And so Poland was swallowed up by Russia. No free elections. Stalin got what he wanted. And the West, the United States and Britain, got nothing, thanks primarily to Roosevelt. Stalin, again, he promised to help with the war in Japan in return for the U.S. and Britain essentially abandoning our Chinese allies. And then Russia got all these other concessions in Asia. And look at what happened in the decades that followed. What about the U.N.? That was established at the Yalta Conference. There's going to be we've had all these failures with these groups of nations coming together to make peace. But now, and look at what happened, World War II. We can't have another one of these, not with the way weapons are progressing in power. So the United Nations sprung from that, and Stalin agreed to join the UN, but again, on condition, a very important condition, Russia had to have veto power. How'd that work out for the UN? Any meaningful action ever since? Russia's had the power to say, nope, can't do it. What a failure. What a huge failure. And all in the pursuit of a peace pact, a piece of paper. One diplomat at a later conference was quoted as saying, I think Stalin's feelings are hurt. Please be nice. Please be nice to him. That was the advice he offered to another diplomat. And that's the way they were with Adolf Hitler. These scholars, these diplomats, these peacemakers in the world, they feel like that human nature is fundamentally good. So if we can just sit down at the table and talk with these individuals, these tyrants, these mass murderers, surely they'll come around. Surely they'll like us. Roosevelt, at the time, he wrote this to the Polish prime minister. I have a hunch that Stalin doesn't want anything other than security for his country. And I think that if I give him everything possible, everything I possibly can, and ask for nothing in return, noblesse oblige, or an act of kindness, just give it away, he won't try to annex anything and will work for a world of democracy and peace. Well, how did the Polish leader feel about that? An assurance! An assurance from the President of the United States. Surely there will be peace. Surely. Surely there's no designs in the mind of Stalin to take control of Eastern Europe or Poland. As they say, what an utter failure. Stalin made all the promises, and then when the dust settled, he just simply reneged on all of them. Now, the one bright spot, if you can call it that, at least judging by our literature, is coming out from that conference. These three powers, United States, Britain, and Russia, they agreed to this, and you've seen this quote many times in our literature, but this is the approach that they would take with Germany following the war. The joint statement read, "It's our inflexible purpose to destroy German militarism and Nazism and to ensure that Germany will never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. We are determined to disarm and disband all German armed forces, break up for all time the German general staff that has repeatedly contrived the resurgence of German militarism, remove or destroy all German military equipment, eliminate or control all German industry that could be used for military production. Bring all war criminals to just and swift punishment." Further on, they said, "But only when Nazism and militarism have been extirpated will there be hope for a decent life for Germans and a place for them in the comedy of nations." So they were intent on crushing Nazism, never allowing German militarism to rise again. And yet following that war, the Second World War, instead of focusing on that, what did Russia and the United States and Britain have to focus on? They focused on each other. 40 years or so of Cold War between these powers, the United States and what became the Soviet Union. And only Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, really, he was a lone voice in the wilderness, sounding the alarm. Even in 1945, when all of this was happening, when everyone was coming out saying, we're going to have peace, and we've got the United Nations now. Everyone knows. It's serious. Everyone knows. We can't have this happen again. Mr. Armstrong walked the halls of that first peace conference in San Francisco, the first UN assembly. And then he reported to his listeners on his radio show and in the Plain Truth magazine that far from peace, what I'm hearing and seeing in these corridors and these meeting halls and rooms, I'm hearing a lot of warlike rhetoric. In fact, the seeds for the next world war are being planted. Here's what he said in his autobiography, Herbert Armstrong. Here were world leaders, he's talking about the first peace conference, except for the Axis powers, they freely confess, they put oratorical emphasis on the fact that this world is doomed unless the nations of the world can find a common ground for peace. The world had tried peace conferences in the past, he said. The League of Nations failed because it had no teeth in it. Only a world organization or world government wielding military power, stronger than any other nation, bent on disturbing world peace, could prevent another world war. He said, so here on the floor below us, under the same roof with us, were the leaders of the world's nations, trying once again to bring about world peace by human effort and organization. Truly, it was a spectacle. What a spectacle it was. He says, the speeches certainly painted the grim picture. These men knew this was the world's last hope, but what happened? It says, at every turn, Mr. Molotov and the Russians balked, opposed, blocked, and fought. They had veto power, you see. And at every turn, they resisted. They balked at what the West put forward. They fought against it. This is in 1945. And listen to what Mr. Armstrong said. I think that up until that moment, the leaders of the United States government had naively believed that the Soviet Union was really our ally. That's what President Roosevelt went into Yalta thinking. Well, we have an ally here. Churchill was a lot more sober-minded. It says President Roosevelt had felt that he could convert Stalin by kindness, by giving him everything he wanted, by appeasing him. During the war, I was not allowed. Listen to this. This is Herbert Armstrong, and he's talking about his broadcast, his radio program. He says, this is in his autobiography, during the war, I was not allowed to tell the public over the air the truth about Soviet plans or to say anything that was not complimentary about them. I was given to understand that this policy, which had gone out from the White House. This was the White House giving a gag order to Mr. Armstrong and his radio program. And he says this, sometimes I wonder how gullible statesmen and heads of government can get. I continually pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It should make us want to pray that much more fervently. That prayer from the prayer outline. Jesus said, when you kneel to pray to God, pray for the kingdom of God to be set up and established. How gullible our statesmen are, heads of government, Western leaders and diplomats, peacemakers. Now, as I say, from 1945 right through to the end of the 1980s, you had the United States squared off against the Soviet Union. And all through that time, of course, Mr. Armstrong was saying there's not going to be a world war or a nation against nation war involving the United States and the Soviet Union. Of course, there were all the proxy wars during the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and such. But the United States never did go to war with the Soviet Union. But what a distraction. What a massive distraction. All through that time, as Germany was rebuilt, thanks in large part to the United States, and you think about that joint statement coming out of Yalta, it is our inflexible purpose to destroy German militarism and Nazism. That's what they all concluded. Since that time, of course, you had the Cold War and then the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, of course, Russia's reemerged. But look at Europe. Look at the Union of States in Europe. And then now with Britain out, just as Mr. Armstrong prophesied, Britain will be no part of it. There was an article in Berlin Policy Journal about how that after Brexit, well, the sun is rising for the EU. There's quite a lot of, as I said yesterday, quite a lot of optimism here in the UK now that Britain has broken free from that union of 20-something states. But, you know, there's quite a lot of optimism in Europe as well now that Britain is gone. Where will that lead? The European Council president, Charles Michel, he said yesterday, "It's never a happy moment when someone leaves, but we are opening a new chapter, and we will devote all our energy to building a stronger and more ambitious EU. This is a new beginning, not for Britain only. This is a new beginning for Europe. This is a new beginning for the German-dominated European Union." And as Berlin Policy Journal went on to say, ambitious is the key word. In Brussels, there has long been a feeling that the UK has held the EU back from taking the measures that would make it a more powerful force in the world. This has always particularly irked the French. Now, with the British leaving, things are possible that weren't possible before. And French President Emmanuel Macron wants to push forward with them. That's what I want you to think on here. Events are about to accelerate in Europe as never before. We know all about the European Economic Community. 1973, Britain joins it. And then over the course of decades, as they work to form that trade union, basically, and then eventually the common currency, then eventually political union, and now the push, as you see here, to fulfill these much more ambitious goals, to turn Europe into a superpower. 10 kingdoms, they come together for a short time, it says, just a short time. One final resurrection. Listen to this. It says, the UK had always blocked attempts to create a defense role for the EU, fearful it would be in competition with NATO. With the UK leaving, work on creating a defense union for the EU has already been ongoing for over a year. And then listen to this. EU enlargement, always pushed by London, but resisted by Paris and Berlin, has had the brakes thrown on. So the UK wanted the European Union to just get bigger and bigger and bigger because they saw it as a free trade union. And that's what the UK wanted out of it. We just want the advantages of trade and commerce, that sort of thing. But those in Paris and Berlin, they resisted that. They want a smaller, more efficient, stronger union, more unified politically, militarily as well. It says here, it's only a matter of time before Turkey's EU accession bid, pushed for so long by London and Washington, will be officially ended. Endless enlargement dilutes the ability of the EU to be a strong, unified bloc. Let me read it again. Is this significant prophetically? This is the Berlin Policy Journal. Endless enlargement dilutes the ability of the EU to be a strong, unified bloc. Paris and Berlin believe, and would turn it into nothing more than a free trade area. This, of course, is what London always wanted, hence why they pushed for it. They kept pushing for expansion. It says, rather than believing that Brexit portends the end of the Union, many in Brussels think the experience of the Brexit negotiations over the past 3 years has put the wind in Europe's sails. The wind in Europe's sails. What a development. We're only, well, we're not even a week removed from Brexit. We're just a few days removed from it. And when you think about it in the context of this history, fairly recent history, just going back 75 years, what the initial objective was, what it was intended to prevent, what it actually caused, and now here we are 75 years on. Britain's no part of it, just as Mr. Armstrong said. And now the push begins. This development, as it says at the end of that article, it's put the wind in Europe's sails. When we come back, we'll switch gears a little bit, talk about the Israeli resurgence, as well as the Iowa caucus debacle from yesterday, and a few other things as well. You're listening to Stephen Florian. This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
We started another magazine. It doesn't come out every month. It's every 2 months, so 6 issues a year. Watch Jerusalem, and the aim of that publication is primarily for an Israeli audience, but I know we have quite a few listeners who read that publication online, watchjerusalem.com, I believe, or is that in Israel? I forget. .co.il. There you go. In any event, in the first issue we had, Brad McDonald had an article called A Prophesied Resurgence in Israel. And he said, just one snippet from that article, "Today the Jewish state is more secure, prosperous, and powerful than at any other time since its creation in 1948. This success is built on a healthy economy and robust military. Israel's 21st century resurgence has occurred mainly under the stewardship of one man, a decisive but undeniably successful leader, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu." And so Mr. McDonald there is tying in the Israeli resurgence to what we're seeing happen in the United States and Britain as well. And certainly, as we've seen in recent weeks, Israel is certainly benefiting from the Trump tide, from the Trump resurgence, from what's happening in the United States. There was a piece at Tablet Magazine that talked about, again, just how different the direction is under President Trump when you compare it to his predecessor, Barack Obama. And we know what the Obama administration was doing on the way out, December of 2016, as they were trying to affirm the 1967 lines and all of that land that Israel secured in the West Bank, in the Golan Heights, the Sinai, and so on. Obama's people worked on UN Resolution 2334 in December of 2016, which essentially said that all the area occupied since 1967, and that would include East Jerusalem, that Israel has no legal validity there. Israel's occupying it illegally, in other words. And so when you think about what happened last week with the deal of the century, well, I'll just read it from tablet here. It says, to that end, the president has used a series of tools. He's not talking specifically about the deal of the century here, but he's just saying how that when President Trump came into power, that he just right away started to reverse everything that President Obama had established as far as his Middle East peace doctrine. And that was to betray Israel and to reach out to Iran, of all people, as a peace partner. That's what the Obama people were doing. But it says here, to that end, the president has used a series of tools to dismantle Obama's Middle East framework. Trump withdrew from the Iran deal in May 2018, collapsing the security partnership Obama had assiduously built with the Iranians and their regional militias, commanded by the recently departed Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani, who met his demise courtesy of a U.S. missile strike last month. It says, on the Israel front, Trump nullified the 1967 lines, the cornerstone of the Arab rejectionist position that Obama had attempted to enshrine in that final UN resolution before he left office. He did this by moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and then by recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. The latter move eliminated the 1967 framework altogether with regard to Syria and Lebanon. As far as the United States is concerned, there are no more disputed territories. The land is Israel's. It's Israel's. And so then when you come to the deal of the century that was made public last week, you basically have an offer, a U.S.-led offer, Israel putting on the table land from the West Bank, and other little bits here and there that would effectively double the size, as they said last week, of the Palestinian territories. But it operates from the presumption that that's Israeli territory. And as part of this deal, here's what Israel is giving to the Palestinians. It just totally turns the Obama doctrine on its head. It says Trump has made it clear that he is not bound by the fantasies of previous American peace processors who today show contempt for the president's plan, even as they admit their own decades-long failure. See, they never brought peace. They thought by just sticking it to Israel that somehow that would make the Palestinians happy. In fact, it just further incited more violence and anger coming out of the Palestinian areas. Many of them, of course, not even accepting an Israeli state, even if it's pre-1967 lines. So he comes out with this plan. It's more or less an ultimatum, actually, as Melanie Phillips said. But look at this from the Times of Israel. It says, more Israelis support two-state solution via Trump plan than oppose it, according to a survey. It says, while 45% would accept the condition of recognizing a Palestinian state, 38% said Israel should not agree, according to the poll. So a 45-38 majority in favor of this. And as we said last week, it'll be interesting to see if this plan, which will most likely fail, as we know from Zechariah 14, but it'll be interesting to see if this plan does give a boost to Bibi Netanyahu's re-election campaign in March. It says here, overall support among all Jewish respondents was at 45%, nearly the same as the 44% overall support from Arabs. So 44% of Arabs support this. Where do you hear this? In the major media today. Are they out there, out front with this statistic, saying that, well, actually, there's quite a lot of support for it? of course, the loudest voices, those in the media and such, they despise Donald Trump and the Trump administration, so you're not going to hear any of this. Another article here, this says, dramatically improving ties, this is also the Times of Israel, dramatically improving ties with former bitter foe, Prime Minister Netanyahu on Monday met with the transitional leader of Sudan during a whirlwind visit to Uganda. Basically, the point of this article is that these were bitter enemies for the longest of times. Israel and Sudan, the Jerusalem Post, and this just comes back to, again, what Mr. McDonald was saying in that Watch Jerusalem piece. Israel's making advances. Benjamin Netanyahu, even as he comes under attack from his enemies, and he's got lots of them in government, in the administrative state, in the opposing parties, but even as they resist against him and try to destroy him, actually, he continues moving forward with his policies, with his agenda. Some real similarities there with what President Trump keeps doing. The Jerusalem Post on this development with the Sudan, it says, upon hearing of a breakthrough in the relationship between Israel and Sudan, Israelis will undoubtedly have a sense that their country has come full circle. It was on September 1st, 1967, just after Israel's lightning victory in the Six-Day War, that an Arab League summit convened in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, and issued what became known as the Khartoum Declaration, or simply the three no's: no peace with Israel, no recognition of Israel, no negotiations of Israel. This was just in 1967. Hosted in Khartoum. It says today that declaration has been reversed, symbolizing the beginning of the end to the Arab-Israeli wars that raged for decades in the past. Well, don't be lulled, as we keep saying, don't be lulled into a false sense of security. But still, quite a bit more evidence of a pretty obvious surge in growth, power, influence, and so on. Right here at the very end, right here in the last days. And my father says this, I used this on the program we taped this morning. He said, the resurgence in America today is causing some people to grow complacent. That's a grave mistake. This temporary revival is just God giving people one last chance to repent. See, it's important for us to understand why the resurgence. God's work certainly factors into this as well, as it goes forward, riding in some ways this tide of momentum, even into Jerusalem, hopefully, in a bigger way or a more of an expanded role anyway. We already have a presence there for sure. But the resurgence, it's causing some people to grow complacent. Keep in mind why it's there. It's for us to just have another chance at repentance. Look at what the president must be doing and his allies. Watching the news yesterday and just hearing some of these foolish statements from Democrats, and then seeing a total meltdown on the news last night. You wake up this morning, and we're 6 hours ahead over here, of course. So you wake up thinking, well, I'll check the Iowa caucus results. And on Drudge Report, it said Buttigieg was at 0%, Bernie Sanders was at 0%, and Elizabeth Warren was at 0%. What? What's going on? Well, they're having to take photos with their iPhones of the ballots, of the figures, the count. Because the app that was responsible for counting all the votes, it crashed. Jake Tapper said it was a tremendous systematic incompetence. Chris Matthews said the Democrats couldn't even organize a three-car funeral. People were describing it as a train wreck, a total disaster, a fiasco, a debacle. And all of these people, by the way, these are the same ones that promise us, if we can just convert more and more of the private sector into a government-run program, it'll solve the problems of this world. How about that? Government-run healthcare, government-run education. Let's get the government's hand involved in business and commerce. I think a lot of people are looking at yesterday saying, maybe that's not such a good idea. It made this morning when I saw those headlines, it made me think of the disastrous rollout of healthcare.gov during the Obama years. Remember the website that they designed for that Obamacare program? I think it was $2.1 billion when it was all said and done. And basically, it was one train wreck after another. This is from the Daily Beast in 2017. It says, far exceeding estimates by the Obama administration. Well, it just gives the estimate at $2.1 billion. It says the construction of the healthcare.gov website involved 60 companies and was rife with infighting. They couldn't agree on anything. That's the way it works in the government. The bureaucracy, everybody has a say. And then just all of this wild spending. Well, let's just put more money into it. Surely we can figure this out. So here's Iowa. That's the official beginning of the race to defeat President Donald Trump, the incumbent. And it's a spectacular fail on every level. And then you have the Iowa Democratic Party officials. They come out with no explanation. All of these campaigns, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, they're asking for answers. And the Iowa Democratic Party officials, they don't have any, which of course has a lot of people wondering, is there some kind of foul play going on here? Listen to this from Rick Santorum on, I believe this is CNN last night, clip one.
The fact that they're not providing any detailed information is a real problem for them, because it just leaves open your mind to if there was a problem, identify the problem, tell what happened, here's what, you know, and give details to give confidence that that's what's going on. But the fact that they're hiding the ball this late at night with the campaigns and this just has, I'm sure, everybody worrying that there's more to it than that.
All these officials, by the way, they're the ones out there saying that President Trump needs to be investigated over and over and over again for election interference, whether he's in cahoots with Russia or now Ukraine, whatever it is, he's tampering. Then this happens. This happens. And, well, I guess everybody's just supposed to move on to New Hampshire. Nothing to see here. The Washington Examiner says workers on Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign already had suspicions about the logistics and fairness of the Iowa caucuses. Counting delays by the Iowa Democratic Party are stirring those concerns anew. The Democrats, remember, changed the rules, their own rules, in 2016 to make sure Bernie didn't defeat Hillary, because Hillary was the anointed one. So they rigged the election in the primaries to make sure they got Hillary Clinton. And now you have supporters of Bernie Sanders saying, wait a minute, is this another rigged election we're facing? How do these votes just disappear? Well, whatever it is that's happening behind the scenes, it's certainly another horrible look for the Democratic Party. As I say, it comes on the same day that you have Adam Schiff out there saying that Donald Trump might give Alaska to Russia. It's just crazy. This is said in the halls of Congress. Listen to Fox News last night as they were describing what these precinct chairs were having to do to try to collect the votes. Clip two.
How about this one from Polk County? Precinct chairs are being advised to take pictures of the results and then text them over to the Polk County executive director, who is then driving them to the headquarters, according to a Democratic operative familiar with the situation. Now, I mean, some of these may turn out to be...
There's some of the Fox people having a good laugh at the people who just 8-9 days ago Remember they were laughing at the Trump supporters on CNN, Don Lemon and who was it, Rick Scott? And Rick Scott went into his Southern accent, talking like a Trump supporter, saying, Trump's the smart one. You elites are the dummies. You elites that read and count and are into math. And then this happens. They can't even get an accurate count from the Iowa caucus. You can already see the political ads that are going to be coming out of the Trump headquarters in the weeks and months ahead. I think one last clip here also is revealing, considering the upcoming election in November. This is MSNBC's Katie Tour last night. I think she's reporting from the Council Bluffs precinct. This is clip three.
In 2016, they had around 767 people here. They were prepared for twice that many number, over 1,000, they thought, at least at this precinct. They had 849, so turnout was not quite as high as they expected here.
So they were expecting a huge turnout. And right before she said, if you saw the YouTube stream, she's reporting live, even as the precinct manager is about to announce the results. And if you saw the arena behind her, there was no one there. Nobody. Nobody stayed around to hear the results from that particular precinct. They were expecting 1,000, 1,200, 1,500. As it was just a little bit higher, but not much. 50 or 60 higher than 2018, I guess it was. Or no, 2016. Pretty revealing. After all of the impeachment drama, after all the attacks, overwhelming evidence, we have to do this quickly. He's this dangerous. You would think that the Democrat base would be as motivated as ever. As it was just another, I guess, garden variety election season for the Iowa caucus. On yesterday's show, I briefly commented on that knife attack in London, how that the perpetrator was a terrorist who had been recently released from jail. And there's quite a few politicians in the UK now that are saying, hey, we can't let this happen again. The Telegraph today said that there's more than a dozen jihadi terrorists that are due to be freed early from jail within months. Within months, a dozen jihadists, they're about to be set free. And of course, this has a lot of ministers in parliament very wary over what might could happen again. Well, with the Boris administration in there and a stronger conservative presence, maybe they'll crack down on this more. As we noted yesterday, even though this terrorist was let out, at least they did surveil him and follow him, knowing that he was up to no good. But still, how are these criminals, how are these deranged and violent minds, how are they let go early? It just happens over and over again. It's the same mentality as working with Stalin or Hitler. Well, maybe if we're nice to them, maybe if we give them everything that they want, they'll make the changes that we expect for them to make. At the Federalist, just a shocking article there regarding evangelist Franklin Graham. He's got a tour set up for the UK. I guess he had 8 stops that he was going to visit, speaking to people here in Britain. And according to the Federalist, it says, it's no surprise then that Graham has once again fallen victim to the intolerance of a leftist horde, well-versed in silencing any voice with which they disagree. This time, it's Britain's Liverpool Labour LGBT network leading the charge by pressuring its city's local government to cancel Graham's upcoming speaking engagement. It says, terrified of straying out of favor with those who can summon placards, and protest, Liverpool's ACC Conference Center duly agreed to pull the plug. So Graham gets shut out of his Liverpool engagement, even as these terrorists are being set free from prison. The jihadists can roam freely. That's fine. But this evangelical and the Federalist suggest that, well, he's being shut out because he believes the Bible. I think it's more his support for Donald Trump. This evangelist is coming up against the administrative state. All of this deep-seated animosity. They're fine to give the terrorists everything that they want. But then you just have one Bible-thumping preacher. He can't even come into Liverpool to speak to an audience. It's an upside-down world. It says, over the past few days, we've been made aware of a number of statements which we consider to be incompatible with our views, the conference center said, presumably after being presented with a quote from Graham on Islam or being informed of his opposition to homosexual acts. It says, in light of this, we can no longer reconcile the balance between freedom of speech and the divisive impact this event is having on our city. It added, the booking will no longer be fulfilled. He's just too controversial. Now, they don't go chasing after the imams or digging into their beliefs about homosexuality or whatever else, women's rights. But here comes a U.S. pastor. He can't even speak. It's astounding. But listen to this. It gets worse. Graham's Sheffield tour stop was also canceled Wednesday, with the leader of the city council, Julie Dore, calling the preacher's views discriminatory and repulsive. Wow, that's strong language. This is a dangerous man, I guess. Franklin Graham, a dangerous man. And then there's an update at the Federalist. Over the weekend, 7 of the 8 UK venues have now canceled Graham's booking. The last one in Newcastle is looking shaky. 7 out of 8, probably all 8 when it's all said and done, completely shut out, a complete and total ban, a gag order. And so he can't speak. This, just a little bit of news from Britain today. Well, I speak at the top of the hour downstairs, so I will leave off just a few minutes early, if you don't mind. This is Stephen Fleury, and you're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to leave us some feedback, you can email us at td@kpcg.fm. Don't forget about the little tab on the TDRS page of the website, where you can also leave some audio feedback, and we can put together another montage of all of our listeners. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.